Good morning, brethren and sisters. We're going to be looking this morning at three chapters in 1 Corinthians, chapters 8, 9, and 10. These are the chapters that are devoted to this particular subject about meats offered to idols. Now, it seems rather a strange subject to us. I can't say I'm aware of any ecclesia that is immediately affected anywhere in the world with the subject of meat offered to idols, and it might therefore seem peculiar that we're going to spend some time on it together. If you just come to chapter 10 and verse 11, and this is just part way through the discussion of this subject, the apostle, having mentioned certain Old Testament incidents, says, "Now all these things happened unto them for ensamples, by way of example, and were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come." Now, unless we restrict that verse to the end of the Jewish age in AD 70, and it certainly does have an application there, although personally I don't believe it's restricted to that, unless we restrict it to that, what that verse is telling us is that the information in these three chapters is relevant to people living at the end of the age, as we believe we are too. So this matter of meats offered to idols is, I believe, an important question for us. So we really do need to answer this question, don't we? Why is there the emphasis in the letter, and why has it been preserved for us? Why this emphasis on the subject of meat offered to idols? Because it's true that in the sense that the first century had idols, then in the Western world, at least, we do not have those idols. Although go into other countries of the world, and you'll find their temples, and the idols are all there. But it's not something that we're specifically affected. Actually, the issue is not to do so much with idols, but to do with worldliness, and how associated we are with the things that take place in the world. And for that reason, it's just as important today as it was for first century Corinth. However, we do need to understand, to begin with, just the way in which Corinth was affected by idolatry, just so that we can understand this relationship that we're trying to forge between conditions in Corinth and the conditions that are faced by us today. In Corinth, everything was to do with idols. As we thought in our first class, the city was dominated by a hill on which the temple was. There were other temples throughout the city of Corinth. There was no commerce. There was no entertainment. You couldn't eat out unless it was in association with some form of idol worship. The archaeologists have excavated buildings in ancient Corinth, and temple buildings in particular, and they've found temples, for example, on three levels. And so one level would have perhaps a theatre in it, and the next level would have the dining rooms, and the third level would have the temple proper, where the worshipping took place. So if you went to the theatre, you would be answering an invitation which was given in the name of the god or goddess who was worshipped at that temple. If you went for a meal, then you would be eating food that had been sacrificed. Part of the sacrifice burnt to the god or the goddess. Part of the sacrifice given to the priests who benefited from what was happening in the temple. And the rest of the sacrifice would go to the worshippers, whoever they may be. So if you went for a family meal, then you would go in response to an invitation from the god or the goddess to have the meal. If you were having a business discussion with a business colleague, you would meet in the precincts of the temple in the name of the god or goddess who was worshipped at that temple. All life revolved around the idols and idol worship. And the nearest we can come to understanding this is to visit areas where religion and state are so closely linked that everything is organized by the church. And I can remember when we first took our younger children to Italy, and they saw there all the Roman Catholic churches and the idols and the shrines, and how the whole of life was dominated by Roman Catholicism. And that verse from the scriptures came to our minds, a city wholly given over to idolatry. Then you get some sort of idea of how things were in Corinth and worshipping at idols' temples. The whole thing was to do with the gods and goddesses who were there. And mixed up with it, of course, as we've already indicated, was the immorality that went hand in hand with the idolatry. How was it possible for a believing brother or a believing sister to live in Corinth and not be tainted by those things when every part of human life was affected? And the outcome was that there were two distinct views held by brethren and sisters in Corinth. And we've got somehow to try and get into the mindset of these two groups to understand just the point that the apostle is addressing in these three chapters. Let me try and describe for you, if I can, these groups. What the Corinthians were asking were really three questions. First of all, they asked, what about eating food that had been offered in sacrifice to idols? Would a brother or sister be defiled by eating such food, when it was very difficult to get food in Corinth that had not been offered to idols, that was not, should we say, tainted in that way? The second question they asked was, well, what about eating actually in the temple? Was that acceptable or not acceptable? And then finally, they asked about the meat that was sold in the city, in the shambles. Would they be defiled by eating that food? And those very questions, those three questions, explain how difficult this subject was. The very fact that they had to ask the questions meant that there was very little alternative but to fall into one of those three positions. And so the ecclesia divided into these two groups, these two divergent views, and the ecclesia asked the apostle if he would give his verdict on which view was correct. So let's look at Group A, shall we? And Group A is characterized by this phrase. And it's a phrase, it became such a saying, it was like a mantra that they kept repeating. We all have knowledge. We all have knowledge. So we'll call them the knowledge group, shall we? And you'll find regularly through these chapters in 1 Corinthians this phrase, we know. Well, what did they know? Well, let's go to chapter 8, 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Now, as touching things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. We know, he says. Now, what were they saying that they knew? Well, look at verse 4. We know that an idol is nothing. Or, as it perhaps more accurately should be put, and this is taking the phrase straight out of Isaiah in the Old Testament, an idol is a no thing. It's a thing that doesn't exist. Well, of course, they were right. An idol is a no thing. An idol is nothing. And they also knew that there is only one God. Well, that's true. So the knowledge party seems to have quite a lot going for it. They've assessed the situation quite rightly, and despite all the things that are happening in Corinth, that wherever you turn, you're faced by something to do with idols, they say, well, of course, there isn't such a thing as an idol. It's just all ephemeral. It might as well not be there at all. It doesn't affect us, because there is no such thing as an idol. And so, therefore, if there is no such thing as an idol, then meat offered to a no-thing is no different from meat that's not offered to a no-thing. Can you see the way the argument would run? And so food can't be contaminated by something that doesn't exist. If an idol is a no-thing, how can it contaminate the food? The food is food. No problem with it whatsoever. Well, that was the knowledge group. That's one group. And as you read through the opening of 1 Corinthians chapter 8, you can sort of nod your head as you go along with it. Well, yes, yeah, I can see what they're saying. What about group two? Well, group two are those that spoke about conscience. They're not talking about the idol, and they're not talking about the meat specifically. They're talking about the conscience of believers and how the conscience might be affected. And I'm not trying to be disrespectful here in trying to give this group a name. Some with conscience of the idol was the mantra of the second group. And so therefore, can we just call them the sensitive group? The group that feels affected, feels offended by these things. And so what they say is, well, some with conscience of the idol, despite knowing that an idol is a no thing, eat it knowing that it's been offered to an idol, that the people who offered it believe that an idol is a thing and not a no thing. And they say, we find that difficult to stomach. Sorry for the pun. We find it difficult to stomach that because in eating it, our conscience is offended. We cannot remove from our minds that association. And if we've been nodding along with Group A's argument, I think we'll probably find that we're now nodding with Group B's argument as well, aren't we? That's the difficulty. And so they say, therefore, it's their conscience that's defiled. Oh, now this is interesting, isn't it? You see, when we start talking about meat, our mind will tend to go back to the law of Moses, where the Jews were told there were certain meats which were acceptable because they were clean and meats that were not acceptable because they were unclean. If they ate unclean meat, they would be defiled. And of course, that defiling would be at least partially physically defiling. And at first sight, it seems there's a similarity between what was happening in Old Testament times and this argument that's being presented in Corinth. But the point of the Corinthian Group B argument is it's the conscience that's defiled. And of course, that's exactly what the dietary regulations in the Law of Moses were all about. But by the time you come to the end of those chapters about ostriches and owls and things like that, you come to the verse which says that they might discriminate between those things which are holy and those things which are profane. And it's talking less about meat and more about those things that we do that affect our mind and our thinking, so that our mind should be related to holy things rather than to profane things. And Group B in Corinth is talking on exactly that level. Their conscience would be defiled because it is, and I've put this in inverted commas, weak. And by that I mean sensitive, able to be offended by these things. The other thing we might be reminded about when we come to think about meat offered to idols is what happened in the Jerusalem conference. And Brother Jim just very briefly referred to this earlier this morning. And you can remember what the issue was there. Should Gentile converts be circumcised? And the outcome of the Jerusalem conference, no, they should not be circumcised, was couched in terms not about circumcision, but about how could Gentile converts convince their Jewish brethren that they had forsaken paganism. So there were certain things that they were not to do. avoid fornication, meat offered to idols, and blood. And all of those things were happening in Corinth. All of those things were happening in Corinth. Remember the 1,000 prostitutes on the hill. Flee fornication, meat offered to idols, and blood. So all of those things which characterized pagan worship were happening in Corinth. And the apostle, when he first came to Corinth during the second missionary journey, had been carrying with him, ever since the Jerusalem conference, the letter that the apostles had written in Jerusalem, which he delivered unto the ecclesias for to keep, we're told. And I'm sure he must have delivered it to the Corinthian ecclesia and told them, there are brethren in Jerusalem and in Judea who are offended if it's not evident that Gentile converts have forsaken paganism. And what they have asked and what the Gentile believers in Judea have promised, and other ecclesias that have since been established in other parts of the world have also promised, is that they will stand aside from these things for the sake of their Jewish brethren. So Jewish consciences were exercised by the behavior of Gentile converts. And so, as that Jerusalem letter described them, necessary things, abstaining from meats offered to idols, from blood and from things strangled, and from fornication, as recorded for us in Acts 15 and verse 29. But interestingly, how does the apostle address this issue? He's now faced with these two distinct groups in Corinth, and the Corinthians are at least united on one thing, and that is, they want a ruling on this. They want the apostle to tell them what they ought to be doing. And the response that the apostle Paul makes is, in effect, to ask this question. What builds up? Actually, it's a question that we ought to ask ourselves pretty regularly. Ask it if you're about to say something to a brother or a sister. Will what I'm about to say build up that brother or sister, or will it damage him or her? And unless it will build up, then we're better not saying it. And if in our life, by the example that we set to others, by the things that we do that they will see us doing, we can build up, then that's what we ought to be doing. If we're not doing that, then it's better to forsake it and not to say those words, do those things, go to those places, if we cannot edify. So what the apostle asks is this. Will the weak brother's conscience be emboldened? And that word means to build up. Will it be edified? Will it be emboldened? I'm looking here at verse 10. If any man see those which have knowledge sit at meat in an idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him which is weak be emboldened, built up, to eat those things which are offered to idols? If he sees his brethren and sisters eating there with a clear conscience, is he going to be built up to do that? Can you see the irony in the apostle's words here? Is it being built up to eat in idols' temples? Well, of course it isn't. But that could be what you're doing to your brother or sister whose conscience will be offended by your activity. And if you just go back to verse 1 of chapter 8, knowledge, he says, puffs up. Love builds up. You can see which party he's talking to here, can't you? The knowledge party, who say, well, we're just building up, we're helping. If brethren see us, they'll realise there's no problem with meat offered to idols and they can come and eat quite freely. And the apostle says, no, love builds up. Just notice the way J.B. Phillips puts that verse. While knowledge can make a man look big, only love can make him grow to his full stature. It's caught the essence of it, really, hasn't it? And sometimes, you know, knowledge is used to make an individual look big. And sadly, you can sometimes hear it, you know, within the brotherhood. And people will boast because, oh, you don't know about that. Oh, well, I've learned about that. I'm sorry, I can't tell you. But I do know about it. So this idea of knowledge, you know, makes us look big. I'm in possession of knowledge which you haven't got, and therefore somehow I'm a little bit different, a little bit better than you are. And the apostle punctures that very quickly and says, no, love builds up. Only through love can a man grow to his full stature. And so what the apostle does is now to provide a message which is going to address both groups and the position that both groups have. Group A is being warned against complacency, because of course that's the serious threat to those that think they have knowledge. Go along to an idol's temple because it doesn't mean anything to them. Well, it's possible, of course, that in the end it might mean something to them. And the threat is there when you come to chapter 10 and verse 12. So let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Why put yourself in the position where temptation could affect you, even though you think it won't? Why put yourself there? And let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he falls. And group B is also being warned against the subtle temptations of idolatry. And in that same chapter 10, speaking to that group B is saying, wherefore, my beloved, this is verse 14 of chapter 10, flee from idolatry. And the apostle now uses his own example to try and describe what the problem is. So look at chapter 9 and verse 9. He says, is it not written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treads out the corn? And he's applying that verse to himself. He says, I'm the workman, I'm the ox, and I ought to feed. I ought to have food. Some apostles, some preachers might claim that right, but Paul wasn't doing so. And he makes it clear on a number of occasions in this letter to the brethren and sisters in Corinth that he wanted to win as many people as possible for Christ, and he wasn't going to put a stumbling block in their way at all, and therefore he would look after his own affairs. He would not be chargeable to them for anything. Now, this was an example to them of love and not of knowledge. Knowledge would say, he could go to the Corinthians and say, look, I'm here, I'm bringing the gospel to you, therefore look after me. That's what knowledge would say. But he's not going to apply that. Instead, through love for them, and so that there could be no criticism whatsoever of him, he says, I will look after myself. In this little section in chapter 9, it's just worth looking at it carefully, really, because the apostle brings forth a number of examples. Look at verse 7. Who goes to warfare any time at his own charges? See, in everyday life, soldiers, who plants a vineyard and eats not the fruit thereof? Farmers, who feeds a flock and eats not of the milk of the flock? Shepherds, soldiers, farmers, shepherds, all receive a reward for their toil. The law of Moses, as we've seen, verse 9, even rewarded the oxen that treaded out the corn, let alone the farmer who owned the oxen. So ordinary gratitude ought to have caused converts to support materially those who supplied them the blessings of the gospel message. And the apostles, well, they were much more than spiritual teachers. They were their fathers in Christ, weren't they? And so children should care for fathers. What about those who were in the temple, working in the temple? Verse 13, do you not know that they which minister about holy things live of the things of the temple? If priests were provided with the necessities of daily life as a result of their work, how much more should they? And then verse 14 of chapter 9 says, even so hath the Lord ordained, the Lord Jesus ordained, that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. And he's referring to Matthew 10 and verse 10. A worker is worthy of his hire. So, yes, the Lord said it. The law of Moses said it. It happened in the priesthood. It happened in natural life. Soldiers, farmers, shepherds. Knowledge says this is what should happen. But I will not demand what knowledge would require. Instead, in love, I will provide for my own things. And lest his own example was not sufficient, the apostle then brings other examples in chapter 10, the example of Israel in the wilderness. And this is quite fascinating, really. Come to chapter 10. And 1 Corinthians chapter 10 starts by saying, all those in the wilderness were baptized into Moses and in the sea. And you do just need to notice the emphasis that runs through 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. They were all baptized to Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual meat, all drank the same spiritual drink, drinking of the spiritual rock that followed them. That rock was Christ. But with many of them, God was not well pleased, and the all has changed to many. And there's a lesson here. In Corinth, they'd all been baptized into Christ. And to take the example of those who had all been baptized into Moses in the wilderness, many of them God was not well pleased with. Why was he not pleased with them in the wilderness? Well, verse 7 tells us, because some of them were idolaters. Neither be ye idolaters as were some of them. And again, the qualification is important to notice. As it's written, quoting now from Exodus chapter 32, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Now, you know where that verse comes from. Exodus 32, the incident of the golden calf. You can't find a greater incident of idolatry in Israel's history. These be thy gods, which brought thee out of Egypt, Aaron said. And what the nation of Israel did in the majority of cases was, as that verse in Exodus 32 says, they sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. Be thankful, my dear brethren and sisters, that the Bible speaks in a euphemism in that verse. How awful it would have been if the details of what they did had been spelled out. Because what they did in the wilderness was what Corinthians were doing in Corinth, in their idol worship. It was mixed with the grossest immorality. That's what rising up to play means. And those words just mask the enormous abhorrence of the things that the children of Israel were doing at that time. And so that's the incident that the Apostle Paul picks on. And it's an incident that's so analogous to what was happening in daily life in Corinth that you cannot get a closer comparison than the two. And woe betide any in the ecclesia that were associated with that. Because what happened to those in the wilderness? Well, they were destroyed. As verse 8 says, neither let us commit fornication as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. Is that what you want to happen? The Israelites sat down to eat and drink before the golden calf, just like Corinthians eating in idols' temples. Israel in the wilderness were idolaters. They committed fornication. They tempted Christ. They murmured, like the Corinthians. Can you see how similar the two situations are? And that's why the Apostle Paul brings this before them, just to get across the message. And then notice how chapter 10 continues, what it goes straight into. It goes on to talk about the Lord's table. It goes on to talk about the memorial meal. Verse 14, "Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to wise men. Judge ye what I say. The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? We being many are one bread, one body. Behold, Israel after the flesh, are not they which eat of the sacrifices, partakers of the altar? So if you eat food sacrificed to idols, are you not partaking of that altar?" That's the message, isn't it? He's saying that the memorial meal is actually a potent force amongst us. We are united by sharing together in those things, hence the use of that word communion. It's only a translation of the Greek word koinonia, fellowship, partaking. It unites us together, but more than that, it unites believers with their Lord. And so what the apostle is going to describe to them is the way in which he has tried to set an example for living as a believer of the Lord Jesus Christ, which he wishes that those brethren and sisters in Corinth will also follow. And the apostle's way, faced with these two diametrically opposed groups in Corinth, is to say, and this may be a surprise to us, that they were extreme. Both were extreme. One group was extreme for this reason, that to take account of every brother or sister's conscience would have the effect of eventually stultifying all activity. In the end, if we took account of those things that each of us would prefer didn't happen, nothing would happen. And nothing would be done. And so what the Apostle Paul does is to raise the discussion to a much higher level. And what we need to do now, because he applies what I'd like to describe as six worldliness tests. Because this isn't to do with eating in idols' temples, so far as we are concerned. This is to do with our association with the world. If you want to think of things which are similar to eating in idols' temples, in other words, there's a religious or pagan association with things, then think of issues like Christmas, Halloween, Easter, and the things that the world does during those festivals, and whether we are associated in any way with those. Those are the things which are the most similar incidents in 21st century life to eating in idols' temples in first century Corinth. But we need to spread it much more widely than that. These are things which are to do with the world, things which the world presses upon us. Well, here are the six worldliness tests, and we can apply them to any activity that we undertake, any activity. And the first one is this, and we draw it from Romans chapter 14, where the apostle is talking about food offered to idols, and whether we should just eat herbs or whether we can eat meat. Do you remember the argument that takes place in that chapter? Can I offer thanks beforehand? Well, can you imagine going into an idol's temple in Corinth and offering thanks before. If you can do it with a clear conscience, well then, worldliness test number one has been passed. So apply that to anything that we do. Can I offer thanks beforehand? Just before we move on to the others, let me just, in case you're not thinking in the same way as I am, give you some ideas to be thinking about. So you've had an invitation to a concert. Do you accept it? You might like to look at the programme first and find out what the concert is. You might want to know where the concert is going to be held, where the concert hall is. You've been invited out to a meal by individuals who are not your brethren and sisters. Do you accept the invitation? You've learned where the meal is. You might know what the atmosphere in that place is. Those are the things that you take into account before you apply any of the worldliness tests. You've been invited to a sporting fixture. Should you attend it? Should you participate in it? Those are the sort of things I'm thinking about. Those are the tests for us which occur on a daily basis. Should we participate or not? And test number one, can I offer thanks beforehand? In other words, can I devote the activity in which I am now about to participate to God? Test number two is 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 1. Will it be edifying? See, there may be nothing wrong with it, but it might not edify. Actually, quite a hard test to apply, isn't it? But how important it is. 1 Corinthians 8, verse 11, will it cause my brother to stumble? And by that I mean scripturally stumble. Put him out of the way of salvation. Is it likely to do that to my brother or sister? So apply that test to this activity in which we've been invited or are thinking about participating in. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 23. Can I do it to the glory of God? Is God going to be glorified by my sharing, participating in that activity? Very interesting, isn't it? I'll just use those words. Sharing and participating are English translations of the Greek term koinonia, which is fellowship. And I've used that same word in this next point, point number five. Can I share it as an act of fellowship with my brother or sister? 1 Corinthians 10, verse 21, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of devils. You cannot be partakers of the Lord's table and of the table of demons. No, of course you can't. And the sixth, and probably the most important of all the tests, is this. Would I do it if Jesus was with me? And if you think about it, that embraces all the other ones, doesn't it? Would I do it if Jesus was with me? And so the apostle concludes, and if you come to chapter 10 and verse 23, he says, all things are lawful for me. There is no restriction to my doing any of these things. The concert, the meal, the sporting fixture. There is no thou shalt not. But all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but all things edify not. Let no man seek his own, but every man another's good. You see, all the while you're looking at yourself when you should be thinking of the other. And how much our activities impinge upon other people. That's why those worldliness tests are so critically important. Let's try and take note of them and apply them so that we give no offence, particularly to the Ecclesia of God. And may God bless us.